This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. This is the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of July 1st, 2024. Arizona lawmakers sent a proposal to the ballot that will ask voters to give state law enforcement the power to arrest undocumented immigrants, a power usually reserved for the federal government. The ballot measure is facing stiff opposition from activist groups with a long history of opposing similar types of legislation and the business community, too. From the Politics Desk, Wayne Shetsky reports.
The ballot question would ask voters to create a state law criminalizing crossing the border outside of a legal port of entry. That's already illegal under federal law, but the new proposal would empower local police to enforce it. Living United for Change in Arizona, or LUCCHA, is one of several groups organizing campaigns to oppose the proposal. The organization itself traces its origin to 2010, when Arizona lawmakers passed a different immigration law.
Nearly 14 years ago, I stood before our community terrified about what was coming from the Arizona legislature. We weren't ready. We had no choice but to organize.
LUCCHA Executive Director Alejandra Gomez says the 2010 law, which was partially overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, led to racial profiling by law enforcement. Joe Garcia works with another group called Chicanas por la Causa that was created to fight discrimination against Mexican Americans. He says the ballot question is designed to exploit negative stereotypes about immigrants.
It is intended to drive people to the polls through fear and through hatred. It is not based on reality.
Republicans voted to put the question on the ballot after Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed a similar bill. Proponents say it's different from the 2010 law, that police won't be able to profile because they'll need probable cause, evidence of an illegal entry to the U.S. LUCCHA says it plans to knock on 1 million doors this year and register 20,000 voters. It has also filed a lawsuit to block the question from getting on the ballot.
This is not 2010 anymore. This is 2024, and we are prepared to fight back and win.
Over the past 14 years, LUCCHA has grown into a full-fledged political machine. In 2022 alone, it spent over $1 million to influence various ballot measure campaigns in Arizona. Now, influential members of Arizona's business community have also committed to opposing the ballot referral. That's a marked change from 14 years ago, when major business opposition didn't emerge until after the law passed. Arizona faced calls for boycotts in 2010, and a progressive think tank estimated the state lost $141 million due to the law, though some have disputed that figure. James O'Neill with the American Business Immigration Council says memories of the 2010 law, also called SB 1070, are what prompted many business groups to speak up now.
Everybody still remembers the reputational damage that 1070 did. Everybody remembers the damage that it caused. And so I think that's why folks are ready, willing, and poised to defeat this initiative.
Influential groups like the Arizona Chamber of Commerce lobbied the legislature not to send the ballot referral to voters, fearing the economic impact. The chamber has not said whether it plans to participate in the campaign to defeat the legislation at the ballot, but O'Neill says his group is coordinating a response from multiple business groups in Arizona.
We will work with the businesses that want to speak out through op-eds, through messaging, through education of their membership. We'll also support the ones that want to donate financially and be a part of this larger movement.
Meanwhile, it is less clear who will be campaigning to pass the proposal. Arizona House Speaker Ben Toma, who sponsored it, says he doesn't know who will be leading that campaign yet. But he says voters will support the measure even if there isn't significant funding behind the effort.
When you're talking to average voters, I mean, they understand this is actually really a border security issue first and foremost, and a border security bill more than it is an immigration bill. And as such, I think it's going to be fine.
Toma has reason to think it won't be hard to convince people to vote yes. Polling shows a majority of Arizona voters would like to see a decrease in the number of migrants crossing the state's border with Mexico. Wayne Shetsky, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Fronteras News, a new study shows that the new uranium mine near Grand Canyon National Park has pumped millions of gallons of toxic water since it opened last year. The uranium mine's operator and the state of Arizona say it's a normal part of the mining process. From the Fronteras Desk in Flagstaff, Michelle Marisco reports.
The Grand Canyon Trust used publicly available water data compiled by the state's Department of Environmental Quality to show that not only were there millions of gallons of water pumped out over the course of 2023, but also a spike in heavy metals measured in that water since the mine started operating last December. Energy Fuels operates the mine. It and ADEQ deny there's a problem and instead say that what the study scientists called flood problems are actually anticipated and were factored into the state permit for the mine. The Trust is a nonprofit serving the Grand Canyon and the Colorado Plateau. It says in the last quarter of 2023, uranium levels spiked to 6 times what the EPA says is safe for drinking water. Lead measured 243 times and arsenic 812. For context, the measured amounts are thousands of times higher than they were in 2022. Uranium levels were 150 times more than a year before. Of immediate concern is drinking water. The mine sits atop an aquifer that feeds into the Grand Canyon and is the only source for the Havasupai tribe's drinking water. The Trust, Amber Raimondo.
The biggest risk is going to come as more of that ore body is mined out, more mineralized rock is exposed to the elements, and then when the mining company closes down and walks away and is no longer actively managing that groundwater inflow, that's where the biggest risk comes from, in our view.
Energy Fuels Senior Vice President of Marketing, Curtis Moore.
They are just honestly just twisting the facts, twisting the science to try to make very, very normal things sound outrageous. And it's really causing harm at this point and making people afraid for no reason.
Raimondo's group is concerned that the mine water could seep into the ground above an important aquifer that provides groundwater to the Havasupai tribe. And they point to a recent University of New Mexico study that shows fractures in the area rock risking seepage.
This idea that they'll close off groundwater flow into the mine shaft is really not realistic. They might be able to close off groundwater flow for some temporary amount of time, but they will not be able to keep groundwater from flowing into that space.
Moore says the water is being constantly pumped out into a lined evaporation pond at the surface and not coming into contact with the aquifers.
Pretty much all mines have some water. That water mixes up with some of the ore, and so some things dissolve, but you contain it, you pump it to the surface. That's why we have the systems in place to prevent that stuff from going anywhere.
After the mine closes, Moore said the company agreed to monitor the area for 30 years. The company is counting on thousands of feet of what he says is impermeable rock that will keep the water collected in the mine from seeping into an aquifer below, the Redwall Muab Aquifer. Moore said the aquifer is under deep pressure that would repel anything trying to enter. If it were to leach into the aquifer, he said the water would then be pumped out. The Arizona Department of Environmental Quality declined an interview with the Fronteras desk, but in a statement, it said the Grand Canyon Trust numbers were derived from the lined sump at the bottom of the shaft, which is collecting mineralized metals like uranium, lead, and arsenic. ADEQ calls the water management a normal part of the mining process. Michelle Marisco, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. You can test your state smarts with our new A to Z quiz. There are 2 quizzes each week starting on Tuesdays and Fridays. And bonus, you can grab the new KJZZ Play sticker at play.kjzz.org. In health news. It's not every day you meet a man who has gone from 2 tours of duty in Iraq to composing a symphony performed by a major orchestra. Phil Latzman introduces us to a Valley resident who has done just that and recently graduated from ASU with a doctorate in musical arts.
Jason Phillips is currently the music director at the Mountain View Lutheran Church in Phoenix. He had always intended on a career spent in music, but that all changed on September 11th, 2001, when as a 30-year-old, he enlisted in the Army.
I was in a place in my life where I felt I could use some growing up, felt a little stuck, thought that joining the military might be good for me personally, financially, felt that even taking a break from music might be good for me as well.
And you signed up and then you did 2 tours in Iraq. What was that like?
It was intense. I was a Army journalist and photographer, which gave me the opportunity to meet many different people, see many different things. I tell people I had some of the best times of my life in Iraq, meeting some of the best people that I'll always remember, and then some of the worst times in Iraq.
Phillips would go on to serve two tours of decorated duty in Iraq, documenting the front lines of some of the most brutal conflicts in places like Tikrit, Baghdad, and Fallujah.
I knew many people who had, many fellow soldiers who had been wounded, who had suffered grievous wounds, and several who did not make it home. So I came home and I felt grateful that I had come home alive and whole. I did not account for the psychological wounds that I carried.
Back at home with a wife and three children, those PTSD scars nearly came apart.
I had a real mental health breakdown where I'd never considered myself to be the kind of person that would ever hear voices and see things, but I did. It got that extreme. And that was when things were at their lowest for me personally. My wife insisted that I start seeking help.
He did get help from the VA and from his music. He signed up for master's programs at the University of Houston and the University of Montana, where for his dissertation he composed this work called Three Aspects, performed here by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra.
Thought of it as building this huge castle of sound that I could live in, and I've thought of my composition ever since then as being this sort of sound world where I can go to for sanctuary.
It sounds discordant in a way, but I know that maybe that's purposeful. Succession, the music on Succession, the TV show that was so popular, the composer purposely said, I did it a little off tune, just to represent the show, the characters. Did you feel like you needed to be a little bit of that discordant to?
Absolutely. I think that there is no escaping for me the fact that my experiences will always be with me, and it's always going to be my music. I think that in my compositions, there's always going to be every aspect of my life, joy and love and happiness, but there's always going to be this thread or this current that is always a part of my life also. And I think that's one message that I want to get across, is that as a soldier, as a veteran, as someone who carries psychological war wounds, it's always there. Those are invisible wounds, not in my music. They're audible.
At age 52, Phillips recently received his Doctor of Musical Arts from ASU. His composition dissertation this time is called Soldier Symphony, and he's currently looking for an orchestra to perform his latest work.
In that work, there's no escaping that I am a soldier, I was a soldier, and I carry with me the memories of my time in Iraq. I carry the wounds, the psychological war wounds that will always be with me. It's all there in my music, so calling it a Soldier Symphony represents many, many things to me.
Jason Phillips is an Iraq War veteran who composes music and just earned his Doctor of Musical Arts degree from ASU. Jason, thanks so much for your time and telling your story.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
In politics news, proponents of a citizen initiative that would institute open primaries in Arizona say they've submitted more than enough signatures to qualify for the ballot on Wednesday. From the politics desk, Cameron Sanchez reports the group hopes to end hyperpartisanship.
In Arizona's partisan primaries, low voter turnout allows candidates to advance to the general election, having only earned a small fraction of their constituents' support. The group Make Elections Fair Arizona wants to put a stop to that. Former Arizona Attorney General and Phoenix Mayor Terry Goddard is an advocate for the measure. He says it's needed because Arizona's current primary system rewards extremists.
They have given us a system of partisan gridlock where any compromise is considered treasonous by the side that you happen to be on.
The group says they've gathered more than 580,000 signatures, which is far above the threshold they needed to meet to get the measure on the ballot. But they anticipate lawsuits challenging the validity of those signatures in the coming weeks. Cameron Sanchez, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. And now from KJZZ's original production, The Show. why these podcasters think Bruce Springsteen should be a queer icon. Here's the show's Sam Dingman.
Mark, when I say the name Bruce Springsteen, what comes to mind?
For me, so many things, but probably most immediately that very famous cover of the record Born in the USA.
Oh, yes. Springsteen facing the American flag, plain white T-shirt, ball cap in the pocket. Some people might be imagining Darkness on the Edge of Town Springsteen, though. Messy hair, unzipped jacket, leaning against the wall. These are iconic looks from an iconic rock star. And if you love Springsteen, you probably remember where you were when you heard the songs from those records for the first time. And Mark, if you're our age, maybe you remember holding the cover art in your hands while you listened to the music. And these images of Bruce and what he represents, they just get seared in your mind.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, Springsteen is kind of as much of an idea, like an ideal maybe even, as he is a person.
Absolutely. But what is that idea? Our next two guests would argue that it can be whatever you need it to be. Jessie Lou Lawson is a radio producer and a drag artist who performs under the name Butch Springsteen. And Holly Cassio is a queer zine and comic artist who has written extensively about their love of Bruce. They have just released a multi-part podcast called Because the Boss Belongs to Us. And in it, they're making the case that Bruce Springsteen should be added to the pantheon of queer icons. I would love to start by having you both tell us, and Jessie, let's start with you, and then we'll go to Holly. What are the Bruce lyrics that you first heard that made you think, this person is singing to me?
When I was in the middle of kind of coming out, I would say, to like my friends and family and workplace, it was also a time where I was really into karaoke. So much so that my friends bought us a karaoke machine as a present to my flat. So we did lots and lots of karaoke. And me and my flatmate at the time, we were perfecting our performance of Thunder Road together. I love it musically because there's no choruses and no verses. It's just one story all the way through. A very, very beautiful story. And then it ends with this line that is, it's a town full of losers and I'm pulling out of here to win. And then there's this amazing saxophone from Clarence Clemons. And that is like, for a little while when I was in this bit of my life where I was coming out, every time I sang that on karaoke, I would cry. So that is like a very specific line for me that I really love.
Holly, what about you?
The first song that like I remember having this like immediate gut-wrenching physical reaction to was Dancing in the Dark. I'd always heard the song as like just a kind of general pop song, and I was sitting in my bedroom making a mixtape for someone I was in love with. I was like 13, 14, I was queer, but I wasn't out yet. And the lyrics of that song just made me realise, oh my God, this is about me and my life. Like the lyrics, I want to change my clothes, my hair, my face. That is such like a queer like moment of like, oh, no one understands me. But there's this particular line where he says, there's something happening somewhere. Maybe I just know that there is. And this feeling I had of like complete isolation when you're like a queer teenager in a small town when the internet doesn't really exist yet and you don't really have connection to queer people and queer communities. That was such a physical, tangible line for me. It didn't feel like just a throwaway pop song anymore. It felt like this is a queer anthem.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you do so well in the show and that you've both just done here is talk about how meaningful that moment is when you discover an artist who feels like they're singing directly to you. But in my experience, sometimes that feeling can be accompanied by a sense of disappointment when you realize other people love them also. You know, like you want that feeling to be just for you. But my sense of both of you is that it was exhilarating not just to find this sense of connection with Bruce, but to discover that other queer people in particular were having similar reactions. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think also it's this, we've spoken about this a lot. There's like a specific way that queer people do being a fan. And also more than that, that queer people do like fashion or nightlife, like lots of different things where I think one of the core things in that is trying to find and build community. there's something that we talk about in episode one, which is there was a law in the UK called Section 28, which banned any, it was what they said was the promotion of homosexuality by local authorities, which meant that there was like absolutely no out teachers in schools and no like LGBT sex education. And so there's like all of these reasons that we've been kind of like torn apart from each other and had to have these kind of lonely experiences of working ourselves out. And so I think often, you know, someone will say, literally, like, why did we make this podcast? So that we could meet other queer Breeze fans. Like all of the kind of weird, intricate things that you do are ultimately just about like finding friends and finding connection and being together.
Yeah, definitely. The weird thing though at the time, because I grew up under Section 28, so all of my schooling was, you know, you couldn't talk about being queer. There was no books, no literature, no discussion, no one to talk to for like confidential advice. So that was my experience of being a young person. Before I listened to Breeze, I was already listening to like queercore punk. So I was listening to hardcore queer radical punk, and that was inspiring as well. Like that absolutely saved my life. But there was something about hearing Breeze singing, this cis white straight man, that kind of, I don't know, the platform that he had, the stage that he had, the presence that he had, it just shifted something for me. It wasn't this kind of underground queer radical movement. It was this kind of big bombastic anthem that was played on mainstream radio. And I knew he wasn't a queer singer, or I'm making the assumption he's not a queer singer, who knows. It didn't matter to me because it was the lyrics and the feeling that mattered more than anything.
Well, one of the most fascinating things about the show is that you also talk about the ways that Bruce's visual presentation, particularly on his album covers, could be interpreted as queer-coded in a lot of cases. How much of his resonance is purely musical? Do you think he would still feel as much like an icon to you if only one or the other of those things felt queer-coded?
I don't know if I can separate those two things. And I think it's that thing where, like, once you notice one thing, so once you're like, oh, these lyrics are, like, so relatable to a queer experience, and then you're looking at pictures of him here and you're like, oh, like, he's dressed in a studded leather jacket, like, pouting with a pink background, like, he looks like, you know, five of my, like, twink friends. And then you read his autobiography and he says in his autobiography, like, looking back on these looks, I look gay, and you're like, oh yes. But I think it's like we talk about a lot in the show is like there's definitely a Bruce Springsteen that exists in our brains that we actually have no idea is anything like the real Bruce Springsteen. And also neither of us know whether that matters.
Yeah, I'd say it definitely doesn't matter. It's more fun to kind of play dress up with Bruce and kind of ask yourself, like, do I want to be him, or like, do I want to date him? Like, I'm not quite sure. And the great thing about Bruce and all of his looks is that depending on what mood you're in, or depending on what level of your journey you're in and like your queerness, there's a Bruce for everyone. So if you like the macho Bruce, you've got it. If you want like the more like leather twink Bruce, you've got it. If you want soft butch lesbian vibe Bruce, there's a Bruce for everyone.
Sure. Yeah. That makes sense. And you actually, both of you in that answer, anticipated one of my other questions, which was, what would it feel like to know if Bruce embraces his status as a queer icon or if he was to reject it?
Yeah, I think I'm quite happy just to kind of live with my imagined Bruce Springsteen because he can't let me down. Queers have this amazing skill of being able to take art and take popular culture and make it mean what they need it to mean. So whether that's a TV show or a book or a person or a song or an album, and whether it was intended to be or not, it can become this really important and empowering piece of art which helps you get out of bed in the morning or makes you feel seen or makes you feel recognised and gives you the energy that you need to go along and do your business. And so I think at the end of this incredibly scientific study, if the results come back negative or maybe even inconclusive, I'm still happy to consider Bruce Springsteen as the queer icon of my dreams.
All right. Well, Holly Cassio and Jesse Lou Lawson, co-hosts of Because the Boss Belongs to Us, thank you both so much.
Thank you so much for having
us. Thank you. It was so nice, Sam. Thank you for reaching out.
In business news, A high-rise is coming to a popular Phoenix retail destination. From the business desk, Christina Estes reports on plans for the Biltmore Fashion Park.
The park is built on 33 acres at the northeast corner of 24th Street and Camelback Road. Macerich, which owns Biltmore Fashion Park, is teaming up with Red Development to build a high-rise at 26th Street and Camelback. It's zoned for a building up to 165 feet, but before any construction begins, Josh Bednarik with the city's development department says plans will be evaluated by different city departments and include a traffic impact study, which could lead to mitigation efforts.
So as an example, there's a signal on 26th Street. There could be a scenario where enhancements to that signal are made or other traffic control measures are installed around the surrounding property.
The developers say the mixed-use project will bring more dining and shopping, pedestrian amenities, and landscaping to an area that's currently asphalt. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, in education news. About 20% of U.S. adults have chronic pain, and treatment can sometimes have devastating effects. As Greg Haney reports, a new study from ASU researchers suggests a pathway for creating new non-addictive therapies.
That could be done by targeting the receptor TRPM8, which senses cold temperatures. It is also a chemical receptor, meaning it makes things like mints feel cold too. Authors of a new paper found that it was possible to separate the physical and chemical triggers for sensing cold. That could lead to the development of medicines with fewer side effects.
We think some of the features of this study suggest that we should be able to do that, that we can tease out what should give rise to a good pain medicine and leave the side effects behind.
ASU professor and study author Wade Van Horn says this was done through ancestral sequence reconstruction, which is like looking at a family tree of proteins. The study was published in the journal Science Advances. Greg Haney, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. It's made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ, your news and information station.